other yak babies. Sex, presidents, and sometimes books.
Welcome to Yak Babies, the only podcast on the internet sponsored by Glass Eyes, the peepers you can keepers. My name is Aaron Herb, my personal pals Dave.
Good boys.
Brick.
Hello.
And calling from overseas, old Irish Nico.
Hey, boys.
There he is. This is the return of our new regular feature, Canon or Canon. I feel like we need a theme song for Canon or Canon to go along with our Emmy theme song, right?
Yeah.
I'm not sure what it would be, but it should end with the sound of a cannon.
Yep.
And insert it here.
Excellent.
Keep it in school or blast that book into the ocean. Cannon or cannon.
So you just heard the theme song to Canon to Canon. The premise, of course, of the segment is we're looking at classic literature, things that show up in, you know, in school reading lists and, you know, the canon of Western literature, and deciding whether it belongs in the canon or whether it should be shot out of a canon. Last time we did Lord of the Flies for our initial installment, and we concluded that Lord of the Flies does belong in the canon and does not get shot out of a canon. Today's entry is Fences, played by August Wilson, from 85.
I think it was written in 83 and the first production was 85. That's what my intro said.
This is the sixth play in August Wilson's Pittsburgh cycle, although it's sometimes also called the Century cycle, I think. Brick, you mentioned this one as one of the possibility for the list. I never had this on a reading list, I don't think. But did you have it on your high school reading list? Or
I read this in high school.
Okay.
Then I hadn't read it since until yesterday.
Gotcha. And
you read it for a class or you read it on your...
I read it. It was an assigned book in high school for me. Okay.
And then Dave and Nico, did you guys encounter this in high school? What's your experience with Fences before today?
None.
Nothing.
None. Yeah.
I never even read it.
I've seen the movie, too. Not the new one, the old one.
Oh, there's an old one.
There's an old one with James Earl Jones, who was also on the Broadway cast.
Oh, is it just like a recording of the play, like the Broadway version?
No, it was a movie. Really? Unless I'm completely imagining that, but I don't think I am. And then there's a Denzel Washington one.
Huh. Yeah, the Denzel one came out a couple years ago. I saw that. I was looking last night for clips of James Earl Jones on YouTube. I found a couple just to compare the performances to, I suppose. I feel like with theater...
I must have seen clips from the recordings because it doesn't look like there's an actual movie.
Maybe like a PBS like theater showcase. Yeah. They do that sometimes.
I don't know. I have him with the bat like frozen in my brain. So maybe it was just picture. Maybe it was pictures of it in the book I read in high school. I can't remember.
I feel like with reading lists and like the canon, like plays or theater sort of gets, it's mostly Shakespeare, right? And then like what, Death of a Salesman. What other plays? Crucible maybe shows up in the reading list.
Crucible.
Glass Menagerie.
I read Raisin in the Sun in high school, for sure.
Raisin in the Sun definitely is a big one. I was reading an article for the New York Times, Wes Morris and someone else, talking about August Wilson and talking about how for years Raisin in the Sun was like the only African-American theater that was like available. Not literally, but like the only one that people would talk about or accept was Raisin in the Sun.
Mm.
Besides that, like I feel like modern... theater doesn't really get... I mean, modern literature in the canon is limited anyway, and modern theater especially. I feel like Fences is maybe the most modern play.
We read Rosencrantz and Guildenstern Are Dead in high school.
Oh, yeah. What year is that from? 80s, probably?
Sometime in the 80s, Tom Stoppard.
Okay, yeah.
We also read Arcadia.
Oh, what's that?
Apparently my high school liked theater.
Like Tom Stoppard.
Yeah.
Is Arcadia also Tom Stoppard?
Yep.
Oh, okay, gotcha. Well, let's dig into it. So... briefly describing Fences as a story of a man named Troy Maxson. He's in his mid-50s, married, has two sons, one with his previous wife, who's not in the picture. Son is kind of like a musician gadabout, and one with his current wife, who is in high school, wants to play football, and has a friend named Mr. Bono, or Bono, how you want to pronounce that. He's a garbage man, he's cranky, and sort of about just what happens with their family and sort of how... it dissolves in some ways over the course of a couple of years. What do you think? Initial thoughts?
This was a lot more dark and devastating than I remembered it being.
Yeah, I'm curious. What was it? How was it framed for you in high school?
Honestly, I don't remember. I went to a high school with one black student.
Mm. Right.
So the way that race was generally taught in my school was whatever came out of the textbook.
Right, right.
So I don't remember diving into it too deeply, at least in any meaningful way, was more like, this is a thing that needs to be covered.
Right.
From my high school experience. I'm glad I read it again, because I don't think what I remembered it being and what it is are very different.
Yeah, we talked about it a little bit with the Lord of the Flies thing of books that seem like maybe there are texts that seem like they're appropriate to high school or not. This one feels like it really is lost on high school kids, maybe. I don't know. I think you have to be a little bit older to grapple with this in some ways. It's pretty heavy.
Yeah.
Not that heaviness is... That.
Brick, do you remember, like, until you read it again, what were your impressions of it from going back to high school?
I remembered it being like a father-son story with a father who was just stuck in a different generation, which it largely is, but I think there's a lot more to it than I remembered.
Right.
There's also, I mean, I think it would be tough for high school because, like, the surface level is pretty dry. Like, there's not
right.
there's not really a lot going on. The main character is an asshole. You know, he's pretty unlikable. And I mean, I could see high schoolers like really disliking it. Like, I didn't much care for it. it's a tough play to like get into. There's not much in the way of kind of incentive, I guess, especially for high school kids.
Just in terms of plot, you mean there's not like a lot that happens, so it's not like a gripping read in that sense?
Yeah, or like just weird shit going on. Like a lot of those other plays we talked about, like, I don't know, some like Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf is like wild, mm-hmm. you know? And like this is just kind of, oh, this guy's continuing to be an unapologetic asshole. You have to dig past a lot of that, I feel like, to get to the deeper themes.
You do. And I think this is an example of a play that is written, there's a lot going on in the scene directions. There's not a lot of scene directions.
Yeah.
But in the introductions, I think we can talk about the end as its own thing. But there's a few different, when they're introducing the scenes, or there's descriptions in the setting that are just impossible to convey through acting alone.
For instance.
You know? So, together with his blackness, his largeness informs the sensibilities and choices he has made in life. That's at the beginning of Act One, the setup.
Yeah, those ones are interesting when the poetry comes into it, right?
Yeah, or just like real subtlety. So Act Two, Scene One. The following morning, Corey is at the tree hitting the ball with the bat. He tries to mimic Troy, but his swing is awkward and less sure.
Yeah, right.
Like, that's very subtle.
Yeah, and I want to talk about performance in a little bit, but that I think that this speaks to Wilson's like background as a poet, right? Like, he's a poet, the king of playwright.
Yeah.
And that stuff feels like the sort of poetics coming out, and
there's a lot of room for interpretation there for an actor, you know?
Yeah, I think that's
our director,
part of the goal, right? Is like give it like something that you can like something to look to think about, and sort of there's something in the set description that I noticed that too, that said like the porch has one or two chairs on it. And I was like, what a vague...
It's a one or two chairs of, like, indiscriminate value. Or what did it say?
Yeah, like, questionable value or something like that. And I was like, oh, wow, that's somewhat unspecific. Like, one or two chairs, like, which is it, one or two? But then in my mind, I was like, no, perfect, because one or two, it blurs it. So you get the sort of impression of that porch as opposed to the specific concrete image of it. In that case, it felt more like it meant to be read as opposed to be sort of seen on the stage. But also, like you said, up to flexibility for the, you know, director and performers and that kind of. So, Nico, you were talking about the things sort of underlying this. What kind of things were you finding when you dug underneath the surfaces?
I mean, there's that kind of the whole Troy's. I mean, I kind of read it as a character study of Troy and his relationships with these different people in his life, especially his sons and his wife. I thought, you know, that kind of stuff is illuminating, you know, but then the scene by scene stuff that's happening is like Troy tells Rose that he's having an affair, which she kind of knows but was ignoring. And then she's like, just like, come home after work today. And he's like, no, I'm going to go to my mistress's house and I'll come back at night. And it's like, fuck, dude. Like, he's just such an unapologetic douchebag. And also, like, I liked Rose, his wife, the best of the characters. So it's, like, tough. Because I think she's always, like, in the beginning of the play, she's always able to, like, cut through his bullshit. Like, you know, she always kind of translates what he's saying for, like, either her son or really the audience. And, like, he'll be saying, like, all this shit about what, you know, like, oh, this man down at work. And then she'll be like, or the guy, my manager at work, won't let black people drive the truck. And Rose is like, you don't even have a driver's license. And it's like that right. part where it touches on the racial issues, I think, is one of the cores of the play, I guess. But it's underplayed compared to, I guess, what I thought from hearing about it. What do you guys think?
Right. Dave, what about you? So what was your sort of thought going into this, and what did you discover when you dug into it?
I guess I didn't have much in the way of thought going into it. You know, I don't know what version you guys have, but mine is, there's like a quick like page and a half intro, and it mentions, or maybe it's the flap copy even, it talks about something like the excitement of the 60s, the early 60s. Like, I thought, I guess what I'm saying is I thought it was going to be more, I guess, wider lens than just this man in his yard, which I guess in some ways it is, but not in the way I was expecting.
Right.
I mean, it is spread over eight years.
Yeah, I mean, it's spread over 8 years, but, you know, seven of it is just a flash forward to when he's dead.
Yeah.
So it's
right.
Skipped. Yep.
So once I kind of learned that was what was going on, I sort of readjusted what I was looking for. And then from then on, I really enjoyed it. I think I felt right. maybe a little more sympathy for Troy than it sounds like Nico did. And of course, I appreciated the figurative
yeah.
use of baseball throughout.
Yeah.
I wanted to ask about that.
Yeah. Talk about baseball. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I don't have much to say about it, but I appreciated the way that he did that.
Yeah. It's effective, I think.
I think Troy's a really good character. He's a dick for sure. But it's particularly the men, the black men in this book, like, have, there's no room in their lives or their worlds for self-expression. And a lot of, or at least honest, right? They're always saying different things out loud than they're clearly thinking. And a lot of the book builds up to one, I think it kind of hinges on that story Troy tells about his dad raping his girlfriend.
Right.
But then following that, it kind of builds up to Troy finally telling Rose what he's feeling. And then his expectation is, oh, she's going to appreciate the fact that I finally spoke my honest feelings. And instead she's like, fuck you, you selfish bastard, right? And she's absolutely right. And so the sort of like just stifled existence of these characters, I think, really comes through that, you know, and then he enacts the same thing on his kid, right? His kid's like trying to get a ride to college for football. And instead he just tells him like, the world needs you to use your hands or whatever he says, right? And just how like, just ground down he is just generationally.
Yeah. And also that his experience with being an athlete was frustrated because he wasn't allowed. He was too old to.
Right. He's in the Negro League.
Yeah. Like he sort of missed out on that, being able to sort of jump into the professional or like the major leagues rather. And then he wants Corey to feel it. Experience the same frustration because, at least through Corey's lens, it's he wants him to be, doesn't want him to get any better than Troy is. But I think Troy would sort of be like, no, you must learn the lesson that the world's out to get you.
With his first son too, Bricky mentioned self-expression, and here his first son is expressing himself through music.
Lions.
Financial support sort of through Troy, but even that comes at a cost.
But then it does kind of seem like the Lions, the musician, like is kind of succeeding by the end. Like he's playing bigger places.
Yeah, he's in a prison band.
Isn't he in jail?
Right. But yeah. I mean, like but wasn't he playing somewhere? Yeah. Or was that a story?
Before the funeral scene, though, the last scene when Troy's still alive.
And oh, when he pays together, him back.
He's going to the grill. Yeah. So he is like, he's sort of like trying, he's ascending a little bit, and then he gets caught.
Right, cashing people's checks. Whatever.
I think we should talk about actual fences.
Which are your favorites?
Yeah, many. I like a nice picket.
Sure.
Actually, I don't. They're kind of weird.
Yeah, I'm actually a huge, I like walking by a chain link fence and
nice wrought iron.
Yeah, that, and like doing my finger on it so it makes a little clicking sound when you walk by it. Like that. I'd never not do that.
It's not a coronavirus move.
I'm a bug chaser, so it makes sense.
So the whole play is framed around him building this fence in his yard, right? That's kind of like the central kind of pivot point. I imagine there's a couple scenes where they go inside, but for the most part, the play mostly just takes place in the backyard, and it's probably a way to frame it so that you don't have to change sets.
Right.
You know, and that's pretty interesting where a fence is both something that keeps things in and keeps things out. And I think different characters have different interpretations. Rose's want for that fence, I think, symbolically is a little different than Troy's.
Yeah, because at the end, he's talking to Bono, maybe, and he's like, why does she want a fence in the first place? Like, fences are stupid. And maybe it's Corey says that, I can't remember. And Troy's like, yeah, I don't get it either, but whatever, we're doing it because she wants it. Yeah, the fence is interesting. It's also like the physical labor of it, right? It feels like something that will never be done. Even though it does eventually get finished, we learn in the final scene, it's this sort of like constant weight on Troy's shoulders and this thing that he uses to badger people and to badger himself. It's like, gotta finish the fence.
Yeah, we almost never see any of the work. I remember once Bono is sawing, and then Corey takes over and saws through it quicker or something, but that might be it. Maybe we see Troy lugging some lumber here and there.
Yeah.
Yeah, it just seems like a task you work on like for 30 minutes every other weekend and just like sort of lingers in perpetuity, which kind of makes sense of the metaphor too.
You know, yeah, I mean, it's interesting that if in Rose's mind the fence is to keep him in, the thing that keeps him from building the fence often is running off to his mistress.
Yeah. Let's talk performance. So reading plays is interesting. I think there's value in it for sure, obviously, but it's something, it's weird because like, unlike a novel or a short story, a play is meant to be performed, right? So did any of you, I mean, I guess, so I saw the movie, the Denzel Washington directed movie. I watched a couple of clips of James Earl Jones on YouTube. Did either of you seek out other performances or try and watch clips or anything like that?
No, I intended to, and I still intend to. I didn't get around to it, but I was going to go to YouTube and see this. I'm especially curious about James Earl Jones's performances with Troy.
Yeah,
me too. I want to see the whole thing with him and hope that there's some copy of it out there somewhere. The clips are great. He's so good and so different than Denzel is. I think Denzel, I like that movie. I thought it was pretty good, and it was a good showcase for Denzel's acting, but James Earl Jones seems like a very different take on Troy, which is just more closer to the character. Like, Denzel's too charming, I think. Mm-hmm. And James Earl Jones is a bit harder. Like, there's a scene with him where he just seems like a badass and not in a cool way, like in a gruff, like terrifying way.
Huh.
There's a part towards the end where Corey talks about how he was always afraid of his father, and like hearing his voice and hearing him call your name was like the most terrifying thing. It's like, yeah, James Earl Jones conveys that terror in a way Denzel doesn't quite.
Right. I think there is some kind of charm to him, but just not toward his family, weirdly. He says, I love you to his friend Bono, like several times, but never to his wife or his kids. And it seems like he's almost like closer to Bono than anybody. But it seems like there's got to be some kind of charm. Rose kind of talks about what first drew her to him, and that kind of, you know, light or whatever the way she describes it.
Yeah, I mean, he's supposed to be, or he obviously is presented as like a gregarious, like he's a talker and storyteller, and so you're charmed by his fabrications and that kind of stuff.
Oh. Right.
The baseball stuff's pretty funny. It's gutting, and it's sad, but it's funny. Yeah. You know, he's like, Hank Aaron doesn't have shit.
He can still hit like a 463 at like 54 or whatever.
I'd hit seven home runs off Satchel.
I find it interesting that the play refuses to fully condemn Troy, right? Like at the end, it really, I don't know, it doesn't rehabilitate him, but it wants to live in the gray area of, yeah, Troy was horrible in many ways, but he was also a very specific kind of person, and now he's dead, and that's that. But never, it doesn't really, it kind of lets him off the hook, I guess, in some ways, right? What'd you guys think about the ending?
Yeah, I don't know if it lets him off the hook. I think Troy was made, you know, and he's on and on about loyalty and how that's the most important thing and whatever else. And and in his way, he stuck to that, right?
Right.
In Rose's way, he was a complete hypocrite, and they had different interpretations what that meant, you know. And he, in his way, he took care of his family and everything else. But at the meantime, he walked all over his wife, and he basically put his brother in a mental institution to take his money, you know. So he was a bad person, but bad people.
Yeah, I think he puts Gabe in the mental institution because he keeps getting arrested, right? So it's kind of like, because he doesn't want to pay his bail anymore. So that's also like a societal thing, you know, like that.
Yeah.
That, and I think you're right that it is like, and kind of like what Dave was saying, that's how those bigger themes kind of come in, is as the Troy's kind of background and like what forms his character is like being a black man in America and getting fucked over for your entire life and like having to be this hard asshole that just to survive and like fighting for your, you know, a promotion for your entire life and then not liking it, you know, and like.
Right. And there's all the, you know, generational stuff too. Like his peers, I guess they talk, I think several times about how most, maybe not most, but a great many fathers of his generation just kind of disappear, but he doesn't.
Walking blue.
You know, yeah, he doesn't necessarily, he can't even bring himself to tell Corey he loves him, but to him, that doesn't matter. Right. What he does is keep a roof over Corey's head and try to teach him the value of work and clothes on his back.
There's that pivotal scene when Corey says, like, you don't like me, or why didn't you ever like me? And he's like, I don't have to like you. Like, that's not the arrangement. The arrangement is I provide for you, and I give you everything I have to give you, but I don't have to like you.
Yeah.
It's hard. That scene is really hard and sad.
Yeah. It's just this constant feeling of just the world just crushing.
Yeah.
You know? Like, there's the part where, you know, one of the baseball ones he's talking about, I was so good, and they all suck. And Rose is like, well, you were too old. And he's like, motherfucker, I wasn't too old. And he's right, because when he was in his prime, he wasn't too old, just the country wasn't accepting of him.
Right.
And so he was too old based on the assimilation timeline.
Right.
You know, and that's just, it's just devastating.
It's also tough to cut through his bullshit completely, because like, I don't believe he was that good of a baseball player, you know? Like, I mean, it's also kind of a way for him to cover up for his own failings, you know, in some ways, like to say like, oh, they didn't let black guys play baseball, you know? It's like, and then he can say like, oh, I would have been better than Hank Aaron, but it just wasn't my time.
Yeah, a lot of that comes out in bitterness toward these other players. Like Jackie Robinson is seen as a god, but to Troy it's like, Jackie Robinson sucks. I was way better than Jackie Robinson.
Yeah
It says like Jackie Robinson couldn't make certain teams I know of right now.
Right. Yeah. And there is that kind of, I don't know if it's hypocritical, but that definitely like double-edged sword of fighting for, you know, your next, for like to get a better station in life, to get the promotion, to get your kids, to have the next generation be able to play on baseball teams, and then also resenting them for being able to do shit that you couldn't do. And for having a better upbringing that you yourself provided, you know, that's tough predicament.
Yeah, and like it's just he's the vehicle for all of that frustration being acted on his family and children too. Like he could be the person who stops that, or who is willing to reject the sort of chain of sort of visiting your own sins and your children, but he doesn't, right? I guess that was my problem with the end of with Troy. I agree with you that he is made. That's a good point, Brick. But I still feel, in the end, I was like, why are we... I'm not that sad that Troy died, I guess, was my feeling. I was like, Troy, I think, probably needed to die. He's not meant for this world anymore. He was never meant for this world. The world was brutal to him, and that was awful. But also, he didn't try to change any of that. Like that scene with Rose, where he expresses his needs. And he says, you know, I felt like I wasn't being seen fully, or I don't know. I wanted like to feel alive again, and the mistress made him feel that. And then she was like, "What about me? Like, you asshole."
Yeah,
reflects this changing culture, and that, you know, Rose is, you know, an unheralded feminist voice here that Troy can't even recognize really. He still sees himself as being put upon by her. So when it comes to the end, and they're all, you know, sort of when he and Corey and Rynell sing the song, the old blue song, it's nice. It's a great moment. It's a very poetic moment. But I didn't feel sad so much as I felt kind of relieved for them, I guess, that Troy was gone. I don't know. It's a weird ending to me.
And then there's the thing with Gabriel, which is super weird.
Yeah. So, what about Gabe? I didn't quite.
Gabriel's his brother who has brain damage, and just kind of like. I think surface level, he's a bit of comedic relief because he says the silliest things in the most serious moments, but he's also definitely the most tragic character, I think. If we're talking about society just crushing people and throwing them away. So in the end, he thinks he's the archangel Gabriel, and he carries the trumpet around everywhere. And so in the end, it's finally his moment to blow the goddamn horn and send Troy to heaven. And then it doesn't make any sense.
Yeah, and there's a description in the, I don't have it in front of me, but there's this.
I do. I wrote it down.
Yeah. Can you read that?
So the third time he blows the horn and it doesn't make any sound. It says he's watched a trauma that a sane and normal mind would be unable to withstand. And then it like weight washes over him. It's unclear if it's a realization that he's fucking crazy, or or if he just like transcended and went somewhere else. I don't know. And then it says he started a dance of atavistic signature and ritual. And then it says something, I didn't write the next part down, but something about God, the gates to heaven opened as wide as God's closet.
Yeah.
It's just very strange.
And that's all in stage direction. And then the last line is like, that's how it's done or something.
That's
like
the
that.
Way that go.
Yeah.
That's the way they go. Yeah. It, and there was a line that's like a weight of or something of indescribable weight is lifted from him.
Why don't I just read the whole thing?
Please.
Gabriel, with great fanfare, braces himself to blow. The trumpet is without a mouthpiece. He puts the end of it into his mouth and blows with great force, like a man who has been waiting some 20-odd years for this single moment. No sound comes out of the trumpet. He braces himself and blows again with the same result. A third time, he blows. There is a weight of impossible description that falls away and leaves him bare and exposed to a frightful realization. It is a trauma that a sane and normal mind would be unable to withstand. He begins to dance, a slow, strange dance, eerie and life-giving, a dance of atavistic signature and ritual. Lyons attempts to embrace him. Gabriel pushes Lyons away. He begins to howl in what is an attempt at a song, or perhaps a song turning back into itself in an attempt at speech. He finishes his dance, and the gates of heaven stand open as wide as God's closet. That's the way that go.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that's the way that go is not in italics, so it seems like Gabriel
says that's it. The line. So he obviously is dancing the stage and then says that, and that's the end of the play. So I read that. I bet I read it several times last night trying to figure out what it all meant. It's lovely writing, and I really like the language there. I landed on, because of my interpretation of the play too, that Gabe is relieved that Troy is dead in some ways, right? He's like lifted, or he's sort of done his job, which is to usher Troy into heaven, and the sort of the frightful realization is that sense of like, oh yeah, this is over now. But I don't know if that's right. It doesn't seem right. That's how I found it.
Yeah. Or I mean, potentially like, I mean, when I first saw, like, you know, he has that, like, realization that would, whatever, it almost seems like my first reaction was he's realizing that he's not actually the angel Gabriel, and, like, but he's just crazy enough that it's, like, he somehow, like, survives it, I guess, because it would have crippled the normal mind. I don't know, right. But that's not...
Well, his whole thing earlier is that he, I think... When Troy dies, he's going to blow his horn and the gates, St. Peter's going to open the gates for Troy. So finally this moment comes, right. Troy is dead, he blows his horn, but nothing comes out. It's like futility.
Right, but then the gates open anyway.
But then the gates open and he gets in anyway.
Right. Yeah.
Or at least in Gabe's perception.
That would be weird to see dramatized. Like, where do the fucking gates come from? Like, when does that happen?
And how big is God's closet?
And what's in there?
Robes he got, yeah.
Maybe there's lots just a...
God skeletons.
Yeah. There's like a ruler on top of the thing. It's like God's wardrobe, God's closet, God's French doors. It's like, that's too big.
God's junk drawer, yeah.
Some old gaming systems that God doesn't play so much anymore, but he can't quite bring himself to sell, so they're still
God
there.
God has Ouya.
Some weird,
some pants that fit God really well maybe 5 years ago, but not so much anymore. But he's worried about, well, I'm gonna try and get in better shape, so I'll fit them eventually.
God's been letting himself go, but he's still got aspirational skinny clothes.
Yeah, a coat that looked cool on God, but danger.
But we'll probably come back.
I think the ending is Troy being forgiven.
Interesting.
And I think it's
by whom?
By his family. Because I think, you know, Gabriel thinks he's some kind of angel messenger and it's going to blow the horn, but it doesn't work. So instead, he just does his own crazy dance and he gets him in anyway. And so I think, for as much of a bastard Troy was, he was also the central. You know, this is also a generation where the patriarch of the family is the most important. You know, that might still be true today for many families, but I think particularly in the 50s and 60s, it was just like, it doesn't matter if the patriarch's an asshole, it's his family. You know, and this is Troy's family. And Troy's family, as Rose puts it, is a bunch of halves, right? None of them are fully related. They're all, but Troy's the connective tissue between all of them, including that baby that they're now just raising. Right, that has nothing to do with Rose. I guess technically it's Lyons and Corey's sister,
half sister,
or half sister. So Troy, even in his death, is still the thing that binds them all together. And the implication is they're going to remain a family.
Yeah, yeah, totally. Corey and Rynell bond, you know, very quickly. It's very cute in that way. Yeah. That's a good reading of it. I like that. That's like Gabe's version of forgiveness or his like redemption in some way. Folks, let's roll the cannon out here. I'm gonna get the cannon. Creak, 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 creak. Okay, now we have the cannon set up. Now, what do we do? Do we load fences into the cannon and fire it out into the sea, or do we keep fences in the cannon? What's our judgment? Nico, I'll start with you.
I'm firing.
You're firing?
I'm firing.
Wow.
I'm firing. Rick. Just, I think I wouldn't want to teach this in high school, like, but I don't have anything to replace with, so I feel bad.
I'm keeping it, though. I think I would posit that this is a college play and not a high school play. I think to get into a lot of it, I think, so in the beginning, there's the play setup that Wilson wrote. There's the part that talks about how, like, the European immigrants came and the city ate them up and helped them prosper and things grew. And yeah. Then when the black people came, it spit them out, right? I think that is accessible to the high schoolers, but I think a lot, like, we didn't even really talk about the rape scene, but that is very subtle and very complicated. And I think to really unpack most of the racial stuff, I think for good reason, there's no white people in this book. There's a couple of white people right. referenced, but there's no white characters. And I think in order to really unpack that in a way that's meaningful, I think a more robust tool set than is typically available to high schoolers nowadays is probably required.
That makes sense. Dave?
I'm with Rick for sure on it being a college level text. I think I'd like to read it again. For sure, pick up what I missed the first time. I think I'd also like to read some of his other work. Like, this one won a Pulitzer, another play of his won a Pulitzer. Like, a lot of his yeah. work has won major prizes, and I, not that he can have only one entry in the canon, I guess, but, you know, I'd like to maybe go through some of these and see if any of them jump out as maybe speaking a little more to present day kids, possibly, than this does. Similar to what I was talking about earlier.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was looking through some of the descriptions of the other plays in the Pittsburgh cycle.
But for now, I mean, if I had to decide now, I would say keep it in the canon.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah. I'm voting the same way. Keep it in, probably a college level text, but still worth reading. I was reading descriptions of some of the other plays in the Pittsburgh cycle last night, and they all sound really interesting. And I wonder...
So is the cycle, it's 10 plays that all take place in different decades in the same neighborhood? Did I read that Pittsburgh, correctly?
I'm not sure it's the same neighborhood exactly. But yeah, so it's. I wonder if there are other plays that have different references that, you know, contemporary students would find easier to grapple with, or potentially are. I don't know. But I want to read more of them, or at least maybe watch more of them and see what's out there. Mm-hmm. Well, good. Fences stays and is spared the canon for now. Not forever, I suppose. I don't think we're new.
Read it again in 100 years.
There's no return to the canon. Listeners.
It's a lifetime appointment.
Dark, listeners, tell us what you thought about Fences, and tell us that on Twitter at YakBabies, and email us as well, yakbabiespodcast@gmail.com, is where you can get hold of us.
Touching.
We're not touching anymore.
You don't want to touch Aaron.
Definitely not. And let us know there. Also, find us on Patreon. Patreon.com/YakBabies is where our secret bonus podcast lives. For $1 a month, you can access it. There's all kinds of fun happening there. Things we should be telling you, but are telling you for a dollar. So we're blackmailing ourselves. That's fine. And then we have merch, by the way. There's merch out there. The links are on Twitter. What's the main site for that, Brick?
Spreadshirt.yakbabies, maybe? It's Spreadshirt, okay. Search YakBabies, and we're like the 13th thing, because there's a lot of cute yak things there.
Oh, nice.
Just go on our Twitter. I I'm open there. They're super.
They're great. There's some really good stuff. There's a shirt, Dave's famous quote about toast on there that is priceless. So I do encourage you all to buy that.
The shirts are great, but the mugs are where it's.
Mugs are also good. Yeah, lots of good stuff on our merch site there. So do all that, and then we'll see you next time. Until then, Yak Babies, yakking off.
The Yak Babies would like to thank all their loyal listeners and especially their patrons past and present, including Michael, Bonnie, Sebastian, David, and William Howard Taft.